I'd like to deal with a difficulty some people find about the whole idea of prayer. Somebody put it to me by saying, I can believe in God all right, but what I can't swallow is this idea of him listening to several hundred million human beings who are all addressing him at the same moment. And I find quite a lot of people feel that difficulty.
That was the voice of the British writer and scholar C.S. Lewis. Most people know his name through his authorship of a beloved series of children's books called The Chronicles of Narnia. But Lewis was equally famous because he spent the first three decades of his life as an avowed atheist. That is, until his rigorous studies at the University of Oxford led him to conclude that it made more sense to believe in God than to defend his unbelief in God. Lewis famously concluded, nearly all that we call human history, money, poverty, ambition, war, prostitution, classes, empires, slavery, is the long, terrible story of man trying to find something other than God which will make him happy. Lewis's writings in defense of Christianity are known as Christian apologetics. Any theology student will tell you that they have read the works of hundreds of Christian apologists. And that word comes from an ancient Greek word, apologia. And that word means a lot more than just saying, I'm sorry. An apologia is a carefully reasoned defense of a belief system. Now, I am certainly no C.S. Lewis, but I have certainly written more than a few apologias, not in defense of Christianity, but in defense of the American South. I've spent the last dozen or so years trying to defend the goodness of this region, despite its history of engaging enthusiastically in all of the sins that C.S. Lewis included in his, and I quote, long, terrible story. Some people who feel as I do about the South choose to write and publish their Southern apologetics. Others choose to deliver them with electric guitars and big old amps. That song is called The Southern Thing. It is from the 2001 album Southern Rock Opera by the legendary Southern rock band Drive-By Truckers. For years, my mission has run parallel to the guy who wrote that song, a founding member of the Truckers, Patterson Hood. Both of us are guilty of loving the fact that we are Southerners. Both of us have heard from hundreds of people who believe Southerners, like his song says, are not too bright. People who wonder how, given the long, terrible story of this place, we can even sleep at night. And perhaps that is why Patterson Hood and I have been fast friends since the night we met back in 1995. In this episode of Salvation South Deluxe, you will not hear me interviewing someone I don't know very well. You're just going to hear two old friends talking. Two old friends who love the redemptive rush of rock and roll. Two old friends who are both privileged or perhaps doomed to be Southern apologists. Two old friends who still feel the South can rise above its long, terrible history. Today, we sit down on our front porch with the co-founder of one of the most important musical acts to come out of the South in the last half century, the Drive-By Truckers. Athens, Georgia's music scene, out of which the Truckers rose, first became legendary around the world in the early 1980s with the rise of bands like R.E.M., the B-52s, and Pylon. And I am a lucky, lucky man because my college days at the University of Georgia coincided with all that. I left Athens in 1983, lived in New York City for several years, and came back to Georgia in 1989. And I discovered when I got back that the music scene in my beloved Athens was as lively as ever. The 40 Watt Club, the music scene's headquarters, was still operating, just in a much larger space, the same one it occupies today. And by the early 1990s, a host of other music venues were putting on shows, including a small joint on Clayton Street called the Hi-Hat. One night in 1995, I went to the Hi-Hat to see my cousin Greg Reese play. Greg, at the time, led a country band called Redneck Grease Deluxe. And that night, though, he was scheduled to play solo acoustic alongside another Greg with a guitar, Greg Smalley, Gregory Dean Smalley, to be precise. For a while, the two Gregs had played occasional acoustic sets under the name Small Grease. Gregory Dean Smalley was a legend in the alt-country scene in Atlanta, and that show at the Hi-Hat was actually one of the last he would ever play. Dying of AIDS, he was getting feebler by the day. And I got to the Hi-Hat early that night, and my cousin Greg Reese, told me that he wanted to introduce me to the club's sound man, who had just moved to Athens from Alabama.
I met you at the Hi-Hat.
Uh-huh.
And you were doing sound when my cousin Greg and Greg Smalley were doing Small Grease. Well, I just remember Greg introducing me to you. And, you know, we start talking about music and stuff. And you're telling me, you know, you used to have this band in Alabama. And I'm,
right.
Well, where in Alabama did you grow up? And you said Muscle Shoals. And I was like, your last name's Hood. Are you any kin to David?
Right.
And you said, he's my daddy.
Right.
And we've been friends ever since.
Yep. I know a place.
Ain't nobody crying. I had been a fan of Patterson's father, David Hood, for ages because he was the bass player in the legendary Muscle Shoals Rhythm Section, a group of session musicians that played on hundreds of legendary records by the likes of Wilson Pickett, Staples Singers, Aretha Franklin, and hundreds more. Patterson's dad was so important to the Muscle Shoals sound that he even got a shout out from Mavis Staples herself on their giant hit, I'll Take You There. I asked Patterson about this for a previous Salvation South Deluxe episode on Muscle Shoals.
I vividly remember riding down the road with my grandmother driving and the radio on and hearing I'll Take You There and knowing that was my dad and thinking that was the coolest thing in the world when Mavis started saying, David, little David.
Little David.
That's my dad, you know.
So on that night in 1995, when this guy told me his daddy was a fellow who was one of the greatest bass players who had ever walked the face of the earth, I was a little starstruck. But more importantly, to me anyway, was that I instantly realized that Patterson Hood was somebody I could talk to about some stuff that mattered a great deal to me, the musical history of the South and the Jim Crow era. When black and white musicians dared to play together despite threats of racist violence. So that night was the start of our friendship, one that stands to this day, more than 30 years later. When I asked Patterson that night what caused him to move from Alabama to Athens, he said he had needed a change. The band he had played in since 1986 with his best friend Mike Cooley, Adam's house cat, had broken up bitterly.
Adam's house cat became a really
good band. And when Adam's House Cat broke up, it nearly killed us. I mean, it literally nearly killed us.
To Patterson, Athens, Georgia represented a fresh start.
I'd been a total abject failure at everything in my life, literally, until I was 30 years old. And on April Fool's Day, 1994, a week after my 30th birthday, I moved to Athens, Georgia. And that's literally when my life began. Like, all the good stuff in my life began then. All of a sudden, there was, like, people who got what I did. And, you know, and that community enabled me to become who I became.
He grabbed every gig he could get as a sound man to make money. And sometimes those gigs brought him to Atlanta, where I was living in a house that had a spare bedroom upstairs, where Patterson could sleep when he needed to stay overnight in town. All the time he was writing songs, a bunch of which I first heard as we sat at my kitchen table. And he was playing them at solo shows. But what he wanted most of all was to form a new band, one that would reunite him with Mike Cooley.
When we started the Truckers, you know, I mean, my idea for forming the Truckers was to try to lure Cooley back into playing with me, because he had given up playing with me. He had moved on, and I had a vision for this band I wanted to do, and he was the key ingredient for it. That and our chemistry we had. And so I had to sell him on giving this one more go. First day of the Truckers was June 10th, 1996. It was a day of studio time, and we cut five songs, two of which became the single, Nine Bullets and Bulldozers and Dirt.
Mate's gun got nine bullets in it, nine bullets in my roommate's gun.
And we cut those five songs on June 10th. I met Rebecca, who is now my wife, on June 13th. It was a crazy week.
Since that first recording session three decades ago, the Truckers have reached international fame and success. And I got to watch my buddy's band go from crashing at my place to performing for huge fanatical audiences on stages across the world, and achieving widespread and deeply deserved, I believe, critical acclaim. Most recently, for the 22nd anniversary of their 2004 album, Decoration Day, the Truckers released The Definitive Decoration Day, a comprehensive box set that features a remixed and remastered version of that album, a newly unearthed recording of an acoustic drive-by Truckers show from that era, plus a beautiful book that tells the story of that era in the band's life, a time when they took on a new guitar player. That guitar player's name is Jason Isbell, and Decoration Day was the first drive-by Truckers album that included Isbell and his songwriting. To mark the release of the Definitive Decoration Day, Isbell reunited with the Truckers for a spectacular performance on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. We'll get back to that reunion a little bit later, but I think y'all first need to hear about what was going on with the Drive-By Truckers at the time Isbell joined the band in 2001, when he was only 22 years old. When the Truckers released their second album, Pizza Deliverance, in 1999, they were already working on a much more ambitious idea. Back in 1995, Patterson and his Athens friend Earl Hicks, who would later become the Truckers' bass player, had started writing a screenplay, a fictionalized version of the life and death of a legendary Southern rock band, Lynyrd Skynyrd. Skynyrd, of course, had famously lost three band members in a 1977 plane crash. Hood and Hicks named their fictional band Betamax Guillotine. The name came from a legend about what exactly killed the band's lead singer, Ronnie Van Zant, in that plane crash. The legend said that when the band's Convair CV-240 plowed into the woods of South Mississippi, the videotape player mounted in the plane's bulkhead, a Betamax, had dislodged and decapitated Van Zandt. Now, Lynyrd Skynyrd's drummer, Artemus Pyle, who survived the crash, said the legend wasn't fact, but y'all know how Southerners are. We never let the truth get in the way of a good story. Hood and Hicks had finished the outline of the movie script, and they had set it aside. But after the band came together, they started thinking. The story of Betamax Guillotine could become a rock opera, a two-disc concept album. Now, a rock opera was a big ambition for a band that was still playing small venues, but some help came unexpectedly from an old friend of Patterson's father, David.
There's a guy named Dick Cooper who was the first person to work for the band when we actually hired someone to work for us. He was one of the only people when we were writing Southern Rock Opera that got it. And like not only got it, but like enthusiastically all in got it. He was an old friend of my dad's who came up in the whole Muscle Shoals thing. And before that was a civil rights reporter down in Birmingham during that era, and basically got run out of town by Bull Connor. They were threatening his life, and he moved to Muscle Shoals and integrated into that scene there, and was just one of those guys, not a musician, but just one of those guys on the ground doing whatever needs to be done.
Cooper had been a tour manager for several bands, including one that opened for Skynyrd during the 1977 tour to support their album Street Survivors. But that tour ended in the disastrous plane crash. Hood spent a lot of time at Cooper's house in Alabama, soaking up the man's stories from that final Skynyrd tour as he continued to work on the rock opera. Cooper's roommate at the time was a young musician from nearby Killen, Alabama, named Shauna Tucker, a bass player and songwriter who would later join the Truckers herself after Hicks left the band. One evening, Tucker invited another songwriter over, Jason Isbell.
One night, we were all sitting around playing guitar. He and I just immediately had this click chemistry that was unreal. And I remember I had just written the Southern Van. And we were taking turns playing each other's songs. He played me this amazing thing he had just written called Superman's a Damn Fool, which has never been recorded, but it's still a great song. And then I played the Southern Thing, and he was playing along with me. And the Southern Thing has this weird modulation at the very end of the song where it modulates up a step. And I was thinking in my head, it's like, oh, when I go to the modulation, it's gonna screw him up, because he's playing along incredible. It's like he's playing like he had been playing the song for years, even though I'd just written it and he'd never heard it. And when I went to the modulation, he did too. And I asked him, it's like, how did you know it was gonna do that? He goes, well, I just knew that's what you were gonna do. That's what I would have done right there.
Southern Rock Opera was released in September of 2001, the very same week as the 9/11 attacks, and the big-time music critics from publications such as Rolling Stone were suddenly paying attention to the drive-by truckers. Spin magazine sent a reporter to travel with them as they toured to support the album. And to provide Spin with a little Alabama flavor for the article, the Truckers arranged a private acoustic show at Dick Cooper's house. And in the book that's part of the Definitive Decoration Day box set, there's a photograph of the band that night. And among them is an empty chair. It was supposed to be occupied by the Truckers' third guitar player, Rob Malone. Malone didn't show up that night. But Jason Isbell had showed up to watch the show.
As you described.
And I knew Jason, but the rest of the band had never met him. And Jason was sitting kind of to the right of us where we were sitting. There were some steps going up to an upstairs part of that house. And he was sitting on the steps watching the show. And after a few songs, I'm just sitting there and I'm thinking about that empty chair and I'm pissed off as hell because Rob isn't there and all that. I'm like, it's like, and I just kind of made eye contact with Jason. And it's like, why don't you grab your guitar and play with us? You know all these songs. And so he sat down, and that's how he joined the band. And at the end of that show, we asked him to go on tour with us. And at that time, I mean, he was so young. We left for that tour, and his mama dropped him off for us to all get in the van and leave together. And his mama, she like comes up to me, tears in her eyes. It's like, don't let my boy die. Don't kill my boy, you know. I'm like, I won't, I promise.
Salvation South Deluxe will be back right after this short break. When we last left the drive-by truckers, a chubby 22-year-old kid named Jason Isbell had just joined the band at the beginning of their tour to support Southern Rock Opera, and the biggest names in the music press were watching their every move. One of the first stops on that tour was a two-night engagement at a nightclub called Brownies in New York City. I had moved back to the city the previous year, so the whole band, along with their new tour manager, Dick Cooper, were planning to bunk in my one-bedroom apartment.
Here's the way I remember it, and I want to see if you remember it the same way. It's all five of y'all and Dick Cooper, and you introduced me to Jason.
Right.
And you're sitting there, and you're all like, I remember you being super hyped up.
Oh, yeah.
About him being there. I remember you saying something like, Chuck, this is Jason.
Yeah.
You know, and he seemed kind of shy.
Like,
you know, I shook his hand.
He was overwhelmed. He'd never been to New York. He'd never been north of Tennessee.
You said to me, you know, Jason writes songs too. Play him something, Jason. And Jason takes his guitar out and he played Outfit.
Don't call what you're wearing an outfit. Don't ever say your car is broke. Don't worry about losing your accent. A southern man tells better jokes.
And you cried a bit.
Yeah. You remember me crying?
I mean, people do. I don't think I did. First time I heard it. I mean, good God Almighty, it's a great song.
I said, well, I reckon you can write.
About 2.5 years later, Outfit was one of the two Isbell-written songs that would appear on the 2004 album Decoration Day. The other was the album's title song, the tale of an old-school Southern family feud that sounded as real to me as the Hatfields and the McCoys. And today, 22 years later, Decoration Day has gotten the deluxe treatment.
I'm curious why you wanted to put this definitive thing out now, because it's not a milestone anniversary.
We can't do anything right. Like, my new record tells like a autobiographical story of my first 30 years, but it tells it backwards. And even that, the timeline gets screwed up. And I mean, I can't do anything right. We just play it like we feel it.
How did the whole idea of including Jason in the performance on Colbert come about?
To be totally honest and candid, I don't think we would have gotten on Colbert without him. I mean, you know, he's a bigger star.
I don't stay up for the late night shows as much as I used to, but I waited up to see this reunion. And it was like they hadn't missed a beat.
We all got there about 10 minutes before our rehearsal sound check thing. And we got up there completely cold. Hell, the band's been off. You know, the band hadn't seen each other in several months.
The truckers had left the road in the summer of 2025.
And we walked up there and plugged in. And they asked us to run through it a few times so they could get camera things. And the first take of it sounded as good as what we did on TV.
It was a barn burner of a run through Hell No, I Ain't Happy.
Hell no.
But let's rewind 20 plus years back to when the songs for Decoration Day were being written. The pressure was on for the drive-by truckers at that time. Southern rock opera had sent shockwaves through the national music scene. That album was far more than a fanciful, fictional take on the Skynyrd legend. It was a full-bore epic by young Southerners who were hell-bent on saying, "We are a new generation. We don't revere Robert E. Lee. We revere Martin Luther King." It was a bold move, but it paid off. DBT had broken through with an album that exemplified their whole ethos, Southern apologetics rendered through big old amplifiers. But as the long tour supporting the opera wound down, personal turmoil plagued the band. Patterson himself was going through a divorce, but during that time, he says he just couldn't stop writing songs.
It was a very fertile time. I was going through a divorce. The band had gone through all their battles we had making Southern rock opera, which almost broke up the band. And there was a lot of turmoil and personal lives at that era. So there was a lot of fodder to write about.
Which resulted in dozens of songs that wound up on Decoration Day and the Truckers' follow-up album, The Dirty South, not to mention Patterson's first solo album, Killers and Stars.
And there are about 200 of them?
About 200 of them, yeah. I mean, there's not 200 keepers. There's like 160 pieces of shit. But still some pretty good songs came out of that. I mean, pretty much everything of mine on those three albums came out of that. It's funny talking to you about this because, of course, the very first song I wrote for Decoration Day was The Deeper End, which was inspired by reading an article in your apartment.
My house.
Your house, I mean, in Atlanta. And I spent the night at your house because I was commuting back and forth working that sound job in Atlanta. And you'd let me crash at your place. And I was reading an old issue of Esquire in your bathroom. And there was the article about that brother-sister couple.
I went digging through the archive and I found that article. It was a piece in the July 1998 issue of Esquire, and the title was An American Family. And here's what the subtitle said. Alan and Patty have four beautiful children. Alan and Patty are in love, but there's something sort of illegal about that. So Alan and Patty are in jail.
It was a brother-sister couple who were serving time in jail in Michigan for consensual incest.
And it was actually Wisconsin. I got it wrong in the song. That's the only thing I got wrong, but I got that wrong. But Michigan sounds better. The point to me was that it wasn't the South. I thought that was like the punchline. It was like the fact that I'm reading this article just fully, you know, waiting for the Alabama to drop. And then it's like, Wisconsin? No wonder they put him in jail. They would have elected him governor. Give us Alabama. But
such, as Patterson himself wrote, is the duality of the Southern thing.
I'd get off work at 2:30 in the morning and I'd go home, and I was living out on Jefferson Road, old Jefferson Road, this big white haunted house. I think you probably came out there a time or two. There is a railroad track that ran right across our front yard. It was like we were on like an access road running parallel to like the state highway. And there was a railroad track between the access road and the highway, like right in my front yard. So I'd come home from work and take my guitar out on the front porch if the weather was okay and drink a beer and play my guitar for about an hour every night when I'd get home from work and watch the train go by. I wrote Deeper End. It probably took me 15 minutes to write. I mean, it just wrote itself. Barely longer than it takes to play it. I knew when I wrote it, it was the first song on the record.
By the time you were born, there were four other siblings, with your mama waiting, your daddy in jail, And your oldest brother.
The first album that would result from this frenzy of writing was Decoration Day, but that was not its original title.
The working title was always Heathens.
One of the songs from those years was called Heathens, and it is indeed on Decoration Day.
Fall of 2002, there was we were mixing the record, and David Bowie, Oasis, and someone else in about a two-month period put out records with Heathens in the title.
There was David Bowie's album, titled simply Heathen, and Oasis's fifth album, Heathen Chemistry.
And it's like, God, you... It's like, you know, and I can't begrudge Bowie, but Oasis, you know, it's like, you know, it's like using our title and like we made that up or something. So it's like, we got to find another title. And Decoration Day was the obvious next choice. In retrospect, it's better that it worked out the way it did, because that's the perfect title.
It is certainly a distinctly Southern title. Decoration Day, after all, is a summer ritual in the rural South. Small churches designate one day each year when people visit their loved ones in cemeteries, cleaning up a year's worth of debris and decorating anew with flowers, sometimes fresh, sometimes artificial. And the band had Isbell's fierce song of the same name.
It's Decoration Day. Never mind to roll a stone on his grave. What would he say?
But they had also buried loved ones of their own along the way. John Cahoon, who played bass with Hood and Mike Cooley in Adam's House Cat, took his own life in 1999. Another Alabama friend, Chris Quillen, who was supposed to be an original member of the Truckers, had died in a car wreck before they could gather. And in 2001, Patterson learned that his grandfather's farm, where his beloved ancestor George A. had played a huge part in his raising, would be lost to the bank. And in the band's earliest days, they had been forced to mourn the passing of Gregory Dean Smalley, the musician I mentioned earlier in the show, who doggedly kept performing until AIDS killed him in March of 1996. Smalley had to be helped onto the stage when he played the night that I met Patterson Hood.
He died about 2 days after I wrote that song. I wrote it when he was still alive. That's why it's The Living Bubba. But I knew he was dying.
I was there the first night the Truckers played The Living Bubba at the Star Community Bar in Atlanta. And I was standing next to Smalley's mother, Nancy. Tears were in her eyes, but her fist was in the air. And the song remains a favorite among DBT's deeply devoted fan base. And today, my friend Patterson is watching as his father, now 82 and suffering from Parkinson's, mourns the loss of his ability to play music. Every year in April, at the Word of South Festival in Tallahassee, Florida, Salvation South programs a stage where we try to tell some stories about the South with the help of musicians and writers. Now, the first time I attempted that was back in 2018, and I invited Patterson to bring his father, along with a passel of other Alabama musicians, to that festival so we could spend 2 days telling the story of Muscle Shoals music. I will never forget that weekend.
And, you know, that's the last time I've ever got to do anything like that with my dad.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm sad to know that he can't play anymore.
My chances to have experiences like that with my dad were running out, because we'd never done anything like that ever anyway. And I knew that. And so
he was in his mid 70s by then.
Yeah. And still playing
beautifully.
Playing beautifully. Yeah. Yeah. Still playing like it was his prime.
Thank you.
Patterson himself has never slowed down since those crazy days in 1996 when the Drive-By Truckers recorded their first songs and he met his current wife, Rebecca. I've watched their lives become fuller and fuller. Back in the teens, they decided to move with their two children to Portland, Oregon. I remember a phone conversation with him after he made the decision, and I told him I didn't think the South could be the same without him. He gently pointed out to me that while I had not just one but two chances to live outside the South, he'd never had the first one. The Hood family has flourished out west, and they remain there. But with their older child now in college and the younger in high school, Patterson says they have conversations sometimes about getting a place back home. He and I became friends in our early 30s. We're both in our 60s now, but I don't think that man's ever going to lay down his guitar.
I'm still kicking. I know. I got a few more years than me. You know, I'm playing and singing better than I ever have. I think the Colbert thing testifies that I'm singing better than I did when we made Decoration Day. I sing those songs better now than I did when we made it or when we were touring behind it. You know, I can do things with my playing and my singing that I couldn't have fathomed doing at that time. I don't write prolifically like I did because my life's just too chaotic and crazy, but I can still write and we can still perform. We're about to make a new record. We're starting a record in February and I got a lot of work to do between now and then because I don't have any songs really. I got a couple and usually, you know, in the old days, you know, I'd have a 200 songs. I don't write like that anymore, but I haven't written like that in a long time. January, I'm planning on laying low and writing a priority so I can try to at least have a good head start towards making this record when we start it in February. And we're not going to finish it till it's good enough. But
you're going to do it in Athens.
We're going to start it in Athens, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I don't know where it will lead us, but we're going to go in and we're going to start recording. And you know, we want to do something different too because we got a lot of records. There's no need of doing another one that's a lesser version of something we've already done.
All right, one last one. Kind of cliched, but what the f***? You turned 62 in March.
Yep.
What are you most grateful for in your life so far?
Well, Rebecca and them kids, you know, is the greatest. And, you know, but I'm grateful for a lot of things. I mean, I'm grateful for Mike Cooley, you know? I mean, I can't take for granted, you know, almost 41 years of us putting up with each other, you know, and pushing each other. And, you know, I mean, just like the story I told earlier in the interview about Jason, you know, the chemistry was there. And we had, when we first met, we had that and that's still, and I'm thankful for that.
Great artists rarely do the easy thing. And I'm so glad that my old friend is the sort who will always keep challenging himself. I remember the nights around my kitchen table back in the 90s as Patterson played his first songs that challenged the old narratives of the South, his Southern apologias, if you will. And I think it's appropriate, as we close this episode, play you a little more of the Southern thing, which we played some of for you at the beginning of the show. Listen closely, please.
Yeah.
My friend and I are of a certain generation of Southerners. We contemplated what we had learned and experienced and decided that our Southern hero should not be General Robert E. Lee, but that it should instead be the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. We made those decisions in our childhoods. In a lecture, Flannery O'Connor said this, "The fact is that anybody who has survived his childhood has enough information about life to last him the rest of his days. If you can't make something out of a little experience, you probably won't be able to make it out of a lot. The writer's business is to contemplate experience, not to be merged in it." From the first night I heard those closing lines of the Southern Thing, I was inspired. Over the years, I've come to know hundreds of other Southerners who look at our region in new ways and who count Patterson Hood's writing and Mike Cooley's writing and their band, the Drive-By Truckers, among their inspirations, too. These people have decided not to be merged into the experiences of the Old South, but to contemplate instead what the future of the Southern Thing really ought to be. We are grateful, of course, to my old friend Patterson Hood for his help and cooperation with this and previous episodes of Salvation South Deluxe. And we got to thank all the members of the Drive-By Truckers for their camaraderie and hospitality over the last three decades. Cooley, Easy B, Bobby, Matt, and Jay, plus present and former crew members like the Barbie brothers and their father, David Barbie, another dear old friend who has produced darn near every Drive-By Truckers album. You've been listening to Salvation South Deluxe, proudly produced in cooperation with Georgia Public Broadcasting and its network of 20 stations around our state. Every week, we add a new three-minute commentary about Southern things to our podcast feed. And every month, we add longer deluxe stories such as the one we've just told you. I'm Chuck Reese, your host and the editor-in-chief of Salvation South, an online magazine you can find 24/7 at salvationsouth.com. This is the last episode produced by the mighty Jake Cook, who has been with us for the last 2+ years. He is heading on to new challenges, and we wish him nothing but the best. GPB's director of podcasts is Jeremy Powell, and none of this could happen without GPB's Sandy Malcolm and Burt Wesley Huffman. We will be back soon with another full-length episode of the Salvation South podcast.